Since I study Thomas Aquinas and am a Catholic Christian, I mentioned above that you and Father White might expect that I'm going to argue here that atheism is irrational. On the contrary, I want to say that by and large, atheism is not irrational. Indeed, properly understood, it is rational. Aquinas, following Aristotle, holds that no position is so false that there is no element of truth to be found within it. Well, if that commitment to considering the views of those with whom one disagrees extends even to atheism, then we should be able to find some truth in atheism. But if there is truth in atheism, it cannot be irrational. That's actually a nice little argument if you think about it, and it's, I promised, very few arguments in this, but I do have one or two. So the first premise, an intellectual position in order to be wholly or partially true cannot be irrational. Second premise, but there is truth in the intellectual position of atheism. Conclusion, therefore, atheism cannot be irrational. Notice what I've done here. Philosophers will say that in the first premise I've said that truth is a sufficient condition for not being irrational, and that not being irrational is a necessary condition for truth. What I have not claimed, however, is that not being irrational, or better, being rational, is a sufficient condition for truth. To put it otherwise, you cannot turn around and say that because some intellectual position is rational, it is true. So in particular, you cannot say that because atheism is rational, it is true. That just doesn't follow. So the first thing I want you to take from this talk is that Professor John O'Callaghan of the University of Notre Dame did not claim that atheism is true because it is rational. If I were more famous, such a claim would likely make the New York Times, which will always publish something by someone from Notre Dame asserting something that seems to contradict church teaching. Oddly, the Times doesn't seem to be too interested in or eager to publish things by those of us at Notre Dame who agree with church teaching. Not newsworthy, I guess. But that's another topic entirely for another day. What Professor O'Callaghan claimed is that there's an element of truth in atheism, and therefore it is not irrational. Consider an analogy. We all learn in grade school that Ptolemaic astronomy, with the Earth in the center of the solar system and the other planets, and the Sun moving around it on epicycles and circular orbits, is false. And that by contrast, Copernican astronomy, with the Sun in the center, with the planets moving around it in circular orbits without epicycles, is true. Well, what we learned in grade school, and I hope this doesn't cause a crisis of self-understanding in anyone, but what we learned in grade school is not really true, or not wholly true. What we learned is strictly false, although there's an element of truth in it. And our teachers were not irrational in teaching us this way of understanding the history of astronomy. It's false because Copernicus says that the orbits are circular, and they aren't. Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler later showed that the orbits are in fact ellipses, with the Sun at one of the foci of the ellipses. Still, Copernican astronomy is rational, despite its strict falsehood, if by strict falsehood we mean that a system of thought is strictly false if it contains any falsehood. In fact, Ptolemaic astronomy is rational. Ptolemaic astronomy is rational despite its strict falsehood. After all, in its case, it is mathematically very complicated, and it contains some truth. For its time, even after Copernicus developed his theory, it was pretty good for telling you where the planets would be at any particular time. Better than Copernicus, in fact. Philosophers of science would say that it saved the appearances. If you wanted to know where the planets were going to appear on any given night, it was more rational to use Ptolemy rather than Copernicus, until Copernicus fiddled with his theory to make it better by introducing epicycles. But if you were more interested in realism and simplicity, it was more rational to use Copernicus, despite the falsehood within it. So rationality is no guarantee of truth, while truth is a guarantee of rationality. In general, we have rational and competing intellectual positions in which we can find some truth but also some falsehood. And I'd like to suggest that atheism is like that. One unfortunate aspect of our culture is that when we find ourselves in a disagreement with others, We adopt the view that persistent disagreement with us must be due to the irrationality of the one who disagrees, if he or she is not simply bad-willed. I am right, so he's not just wrong. Worse, he's irrational for disagreeing with me. There's actually a philosophical history to that tendency coming out of the Renaissance and Enlightenment, in which René Descartes and Immanuel Kant play a large part, among others. However, a much older tradition of thought sees the root of disagreement typically in the difficulty of the subject matter, not in the irrationality of one or another of the parties disputing. Just consider Thomas Aquinas' point in this passage. Is it the right one? Yes. I'm horrified at the thought that I might have these out of order. I don't use PowerPoint much. It was necessary for man to be instructed by divine revelation, even with respect to those things about God that can be discovered by human reason. For the truth about God that is discovered by reason would come to man only from a few, and after a long time, and mixed in with many errors. But the whole of man's salvation, which lies in God, depends on the cognition of this truth. Therefore, in order that salvation should come to men more suitably and more surely, it was necessary for them to be instructed in divine things through divine revelation. The first thing to notice is that Aquinas thinks philosophical discourse can arrive at some rational and true conclusions concerning the existence and character of God. But the very reason for divine revelation of the existence of God and divine providence is because of the difficulty of knowing these truths simply by using one's reason apart from revelation. Most of what is revealed by God in faith cannot be known apart from God's revelation. But Aquinas thinks some things, like the existence of God, that God is providential and that he should be worshipped, can be known. But can, you'll remember from your childhood, is not the same as may, or even is known. In fact, he suggests these truths about God are very hard to know apart from revelation. Only very few people would know them. To know these truths would likely take those few most of a lifetime, and they would likely make a lot of errors about them if God left them to themselves to figure them out. For someone like Aquinas, how could atheism be irrational if, on the contrary, he admits that without revelation, almost no one employing her own reason would be able to know, without lots of errors, the existence and providence of God? Indeed, if Aquinas is right about that, isn't atheism on its face actually a fairly reasonable position for those who lack faith? The atheist at least has such a passion for the truth that she wants to avoid error. And that passion for truth is certainly rational. It is the same passion for the truth that drives the rationality of faith to know the existence of God, to love God, and to worship God all by God's merciful gift of revelation. As Joseph Ratzinger reflected upon in the introduction to Christianity, the believer and the atheist come together in a kind of communion of desire for the truth when they both ask themselves, "But what if I'm wrong?" There, I've connected the title and subtitle. Can I go home now, Father White? No? Gotta do more? Okay. To look more closely at the rationality of atheism, we have to try to figure out what atheism is. Atheism can mean many things. If you tell me that God is a big white man with a big white beard sitting on a big white cloud, well then call the New York Times, because they'll want to run a story on the Irish Catholic atheist from Notre Dame speaking at NYU, sponsored by the Dominicans, because hell if I'm not an atheist. But this is childish theism and equally childish atheism. Socrates, on the other hand, was accused of not believing in the gods of Athens. We could call that Athenian atheism. Now again, if that is what atheism is, then I am an atheist, for with Socrates, I do not believe in the gods of Athens. And since I am eminently rational, as I hope you will all agree, except perhaps Father White at this point, it follows immediately that atheism of this sort, Athenian atheism, is rational. Do we have here any Athenian theists? Raise your hand. Okay. He has two hands. Children?
It's a joke, Father.
No? Good. See, with a comedian, you can't. The audience isn't supposed to actually respond to the questions. This is all stand-up, I guarantee you. And we can all go now to the best NYU bar for some bourbon paid for by the Dominican House, toasting the death of the Athenian gods. Death to Zeus. And I can see from the look on Father White's face that he's about to call the campus police to arrest the cheat and the fraud. So I will go on. It's an interesting fact of history that while in the early church Christians were considered atheists, Jews were not. Jews were allowed to practice their faith, worshiping their God amidst the Romans, who of course worshiped their own Roman gods. Jewish worship was thus not seen as a challenge to Roman pantheism. Of course, Christians always claimed that they worshiped the same God as the Jews. I don't know for sure, but I suspect the accusation against the Christians of atheism, but not the Jews, had to do with the political situation of the Jews being subject to the Romans, and yet the Christians being understood with their worship of God to be departing from the Jewish worship that was subjugated by Rome to its pantheon. Roman atheism had a large dose of the political in it, as did Athenian atheism before it. These gods were city gods. They did not transcend the politics of the city. If the city ruled another city, the gods of that other city could be included in the imminent frame of divine worship. But to stress the mystery of the incarnation, by which God and Jesus Christ became immanent in the world, the Christians emphasize that aspect of the Jewish God that is his transcendence of the city and its politics. Indeed, his transcendence of the entire universe. My kingdom is not of this world. So the Christians were considered atheists by the Romans because, again, they did not worship the gods of Rome. And here again, I am a Roman atheist, and I suspect all of you are as well. So is there any hope for us of avoiding atheism? My point in bringing up these examples is that the meaning of atheism is contextual. Presumably, what is of concern to us here is contemporary atheism. The ordinary run-of-the-mill godless atheism of Manhattan, for example. Presumably, your godless Manhattanite does not have it in mind to deny the Athenian gods, like Socrates, or the Roman gods, like the early Christians. He has it in mind to deny that the God Christians claim to worship exists. That's not because he believes in the Athenian or Roman gods instead of the Christian God, as the Emperor Justinian did. When he toasts the death of God, he does not toast Zeus. He toasts the death of Jesus Christ. Nietzsche claims that the triumph of Christ is so total and is most manifest in the death of the Roman gods at the hands of the Jewish God incarnate in Jesus Christ. In the Genealogy of Morals, he points out that the triumph of Jewish values over aristocratic Greek and Roman values is signaled by the fact that in Rome today, one bows down to three Jews and one Jewess, the fisherman Peter, the carpet maker Paul, Jesus of Nazareth, and Jesus's mother. But he could just as well have pointed out that the triumph of Christ as God is signaled by the fact that atheism no longer means denying the gods of the city, but denying the existence of the God who spoke to Moses, and that Christ is that God incarnate. The symbol of Christ's utter conquest of the Pantheon is in fact the ancient building called the Pantheon, still standing in Rome today, but which is now a basilica of the Roman Catholic Church, with its own bishop and the Eucharist, Jesus Christ, fully present, body, soul, and divinity, reserved in the sanctuary tabernacle of the Pantheon. The God of the Jews has thoroughly routed the Athenian and Roman gods, so much so that there is no point to being an Athenian or Roman atheist. Perhaps here is where you might get a taste of the irrationality of some sort of atheism today, although it is almost too fanciful to imagine. Imagine you met someone on the street outside the Catholic Center here in Manhattan claiming to be an atheist. And claiming that his atheism was the centerpiece of his intellectual life, like many contemporary atheists claimed about themselves, the so-called brights. But then it came out that what he means is that the centerpiece of his life is that he does not believe in the gods of Athens. Well, frankly, it would be rational for you to think you had met a man who had lost his marbles. A man whose life in Manhattan, at least what he himself identifies as the centerpiece of his life, is in large measure irrational. Coming from Green Bay, Wisconsin, as I do, I'm pretty well disposed toward thinking that people who live in Manhattan are irrational. So if I met an Athenian atheist on the street outside, I'd take it that the case was definitive, quote, erat demonstrandum. But I'm much more likely to meet a rational, godless atheist Manhattanite outside than an irrational Athenian atheist. Or at least I hope so. So this irrational atheism aside, as far as I can see, the more rational atheists of contemporary Manhattan and the contemporary world deny the existence of the God of the Jews incarnate in Jesus Christ, the God who banished, indeed destroyed, the rationality of worshiping the gods of the pagans, but also by that banishment banished the Athenian atheism of the likes of Socrates. When it comes to God, there's only one game in town, and you either play it or sit on the sidelines. It's Notre Dame versus Michigan. Sorry, I just couldn't bring myself to say NYU there. Why would you want to deny Zeus, Mars, or Apollo when you can deny God incarnate in Jesus Christ? They are boring. He is exciting. As far as I can see, there are really two and maybe three reasons for the rationality of contemporary atheism. I think the first two can be grouped under the heading Nobo Daddy, mentioned in Blake's tribute to Nobo Daddy. Why art thou silent and invisible, father of jealousy? Why dost thou hide thyself in clouds from every searching eye? Why darkness and obscurity in all thy words and laws, that none dare eat the fruit but from thy wily serpent's jaws? Or is it because secrecy gains females loud applause? The first of those two reasons has to do with thinking about God in relationship to the natural world and its study in natural science. The second is the problem of evil. The third is related to the second and what I like to call the problem of Christians. Nobo Daddy is a figure of scorn in Blake's poetry. He's an anthropomorphic projection from a human being of limited power to a god of infinite power. Essentially, the god Nobo Daddy is just like a human being, only capable of achieving whatever he sets out to achieve because of his power. The name is a portmanteau formed from nobody and daddy, as in nobody's daddy, to mark a contrast with the conception of God as everybody's daddy. If God is everybody's daddy, why is he so silent in the face of the needs of his children, as Blake's poem asks? Well, because he is in reality nobody's daddy. He is Nobo Daddy. The truth in contemporary atheism and its rationality is to deny the existence of Nobo Daddy. How is Nobo Daddy manifest in thinking about God in relation to the world and the understanding that is achieved in natural science? Well, Nobo Daddy is captured very well by Richard Dawkins. If you don't understand how something works, never mind. Just give up and say God did it. You don't know how the nerve impulse works? Good. You don't understand how memories are laid down in the brain? Good. Excellent. Is photosynthesis a bafflingly complex process? Wonderful. Please don't go to work on the problem, just give up and appeal to God. The conception of God that one sees there is of an intervening God posited to account for the gaps in our understanding of the natural world. According to Dawkins, if theists, that is people who believe in the existence of God, don't have a scientific explanation of something, we say that God caused it. Our confidence in the existence of God is supposed to be based upon the failure to understand the world in scientific terms. Notice the tacit association of religious belief with scientific ignorance there. This is the so-called God of the Gaps argument. Think of the ways in which the Greek and Roman pantheon, in the Greek and Roman pantheons, the gods were portrayed as constantly messing around with human lives by unpredictable interventions in the course of necessity or fate. Those gods were very much like human beings, only projected as more powerful than human beings and not subject to death. Well, here, with Nobodaddy as an alternative to scientific explanation, there's a hint of this ancient paganism. We now think there's only one such god, but still, like the pagans, we are to attribute to the workings of that one god the mysterious things that take place in nature that we haven't figured out according to the best science. In the vision of Dawkins and other such scientifically minded atheists, the god Christians worship hasn't truly broken free from the pagan pantheon, but remains conceived of in immanent and pagan terms. So no surprise that the Eucharist is reserved in the pantheon. Christianity is just another paganism. Where the Greeks and Romans were polytheists, thinking there are many such gods, we Christians are thought to be monotheists, thinking there's only one such god. But the conception of divinity appears to remain the same. Pagan divinity that messes around with the world and us, accounting for what we cannot understand. We should acknowledge that there are Christians who give weight and thus rationality to the accusation of the contemporary atheists that the God Christians believe in is just such a God of the gaps, just another pagan God after Christ. There's a complicated history to this problem that some would see exemplified in the watchmaker, God posited by Paley as an argument for the existence of God. Nature is such a great watch. Science may be able to explain the material out of which the watch is made, but what it cannot explain is the grand complexity of the watch, because science refuses to appeal to intelligence in the workings of nature. How could such complexity not be the expression of intelligence? The Christian asks. An updated version of this pagan argument that goes back at least to Cicero is found in the contemporary intelligent design movement among some Christians. It is claimed that there just are some irreducible complexities in nature that only intelligence can explain. Science, however, only appeals to blind, unintelligent forces. So again, in the absence of an explanation in the gaps of scientific theory, we find room for an intelligent designer, a pagan god who plays with the blind natural forces of fate and necessity. Indeed, the advocates of such intelligent design even claim the mantle of scientific theory for themselves, positioning it as just another possible scientific explanation that would be falsified if natural science did eventually explain the phenomenon and thus close the gap. This is Nobodaddy as designer. And my hotel is, I guess, in the fashion district, so it seems appropriate. And atheists are not just a different sort of designer, sorry, bad joke. This is Nobodaddy as designer, and atheists are not just rational in denying the existence, and atheists are not just rational in denying the existence of Nobodaddy. They are right to do so. I've stressed that the idea of Nobodaddy as alternative to scientific explanation is a survival of a pagan conception of divinity, now applied to the God that Christians worship. The most obvious problem of this quasi-Christian, quasi-pagan God of the gaps is that as the gaps in scientific understanding of the world shrink, so also does the God of the gaps shrink to the point where one has to admit the possibility that if the gaps are ever entirely closed, the God of the gaps will be locked out. So ironically, when Christians defend this pagan God of the gaps, they provide the atheists they oppose with perhaps the best support for the rationality of their atheism. For both, God is Nobodaddy. However, the contemporary atheist is wrong to think that the features of Nobodaddy are the features of God, whom Christians genuinely believe in, despite the fact that some Christians do seem to believe in Nobodaddy. Notice first that in the pagan pantheon, the gods do not become human. They may appear in the guise of a human appearance, but they do not become truly human. They cannot die as human beings do. But the claim about Christ is that he is truly divine and truly human. He becomes truly human without ceasing to remain truly divine. God truly dies according to the humanity of Jesus Christ. We cannot expect that claim. But the atheist is not irrational for not understanding it, since we who are Christians are not irrational, but we also cannot claim to understand it. By faith, we know it is true. Consider, by natural faith in my mother, I claim a certain man as my father, and I am rational to do so. But do I understand why he is my father, beyond the simple facts of the birds and the bees? Why him and not another? I will probably never understand that. I can know something to be true by faith, and I'm rational in believing it, without understanding it, and with the hope that one day I will understand it. The death of God according to the humanity of Jesus Christ remains a mystery for us to ponder, not a problem for us to understand and solve, but also with the hope that one day we will understand it. We understand, however, that it is a mystery precisely because the conception of God we are operating with transcends the frame of immanence characteristic of ancient paganism. A pagan God appearing to be human could appear to die, but could not really die. Our claim is that the God we worship did die. His immortal frame put on our mortality, so that in our turn, our mortal frame might put on his immortality. This is, as St. Paul says, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. I don't mention it as a way of solving the problem of Nobo Daddy, but simply to remind ourselves that we do not worship an anthropomorphic projection of perfect humanity. But if we give the appearance of doing so by arguing for Nobo Daddy on the basis of the failure of science, isn't it rational for someone else who rejects Nobo Daddy to be an atheist in the contemporary context? And if it is rational for we who have Christian faith to be Nobo Daddy atheists, to deny the existence of Nobo Daddy, isn't it also rational for those who lack Christian faith? Second, and perhaps more important, at the heart of Orthodox Christian doctrine concerning God's relationship to the world is the doctrine of creation ex nihilo. The doctrine that God created the world from nothing. Another way to put that doctrine is that the sole cause of creation is God. The watchmaker and the intelligent designer do not create from nothing. They work with material that is presupposed to their making. The watchmaker makes a watch, but he makes it from metal. The intelligent designer designs something from the stuff that the scientist has explained, and in the dialectic of the God of the Gaps, was not designed by God. God works with the stuff that God does not make in that picture. If the reason for thinking God exists is that it is an alternative explanation to science when it fails, then when science succeeds, God is banished from the arena of its success. In this picture, Nobo Daddy competes with other causes to create something. The more Nobo Daddy does, the less those other causes do. And the more that those other causes do, the less Nobo Daddy does. It's a great zero-sum game. However, a God who creates from nothing all things that exist other than himself does not compete with those things he creates. He enables them. God is the great enabler, and that's why you shouldn't be. Another joke that fell flat. We're not supposed to be enablers anymore. So. Scientific explanations, I said there were going to be more jokes than there would be arguments, but maybe the arguments would get it better than the jokes. Scientific explanation succeeds not despite God, but because of God. It is because God has created the world to be understandable by us that we are able to understand it through scientific explanation. The DNA genuinely drives the process of development in a living thing because it is part of the world that God has created to work that way. It is not an illusion when water extinguishes fire. The water genuinely extinguishes the fire, according to intelligible natural laws known to science. But it does so because it and the fire are part of the world that God has created to work that way. Water can do what it does because God has created it to do what it does. And you and I do what we do because God has created us to do what we do. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And through the Word, all things came to be, and nothing came to be without him. consider Pope St. Clement, St. Augustine, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. Let us fix our gaze on the Father and Creator of the whole world, and let us hold on to his peace and blessings, his splendid and surpassing gifts. Let us contemplate him in our thoughts and with our mind's eye, reflect upon the peaceful and restrained unfolding of his plan. Let us consider the care with which he provides for the whole of his creation. Question the beauty of the earth. Question the beauty of the sea. Question the beauty of the air, distending and diffusing itself. Question the beauty of the sky. Question all these realities. All respond, "See, we are beautiful." Their beauty is a profession. These beauties are subject to change. Who made them if not the beautiful one who is not subject to change? Oops, went too far. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil. Crushed, why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last what lights on the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breath and with, bright wings. When they write so eloquently of discerning God in creation, they do not discern God in what they do not understand about the world. They discern him rather in what they understand, the beauty of the world that works as it does. God isn't silent in the world like Novodaddy. He speaks to us through the intelligibility of creation as the Word or Logos by whom all things were made. For these Christians, the best argument for the existence of God, a natural reason argument for God, apart from faith, is that science succeeds in understanding the world, not that it fails to do so. Again, Dawkins writes, "There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality." Walt Whitman was an atheist of sorts, believing in himself alone. But even he captures a sense of this wonder of Clement, Augustine, and Hopkins in his poem. "When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I sitting heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars." Whitman does not deny that what the astronomer says is true. But the poetry is in the stars, not in the astronomy. Unlike Dawkins, he does not mistake the literary criticism for the poem, or the literary critic for the poet. The bottom line on Novodaddy atheism associated with those atheists who point to the glories of science is that it is not irrational, and it is even in part true. But it must be said that even if rational, it is typically ignorant of what Orthodox Christian belief in God actually consists in. But it's an excusable ignorance. Christians, too, in their heart of hearts, are Novodaddy atheists when it comes to the glories of science. It's excusable because Christians themselves seem to think Novodaddy exists. But what of the Novodaddy of the problem of evil? The atheism prompted by the problem of evil is not similarly driven by ignorance, and in that respect may be even more rational than that driven by the glories of science. A straightforward way of putting the problem of evil is the following. First premise, Christians believe that God is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent. Second premise, an omniscient being would have the knowledge of evil and the knowledge of how to prevent it or eliminate it, would have the power to prevent it or eliminate it, and from its omnibenevolence act morally to prevent or eliminate it. First conclusion, therefore, if God exists, there should be no evil. Fourth premise, but there is evil. Second conclusion, therefore God does not exist. Nice modus tollens at the end. This argument is not driven by ignorance, since Christians do believe what it claims we believe in the first premise. And evil does exist. I do, however, still suspect that there is a touch of the pagan anthropomorphic human projection in it, particularly in the second premise about what omnibenevolence would do. What we mean by omniscience, omnipotence, and omnibenevolence seems to turn out to be a projection into perfection of our own knowledge, power, and particularly our moral goodness, if we have it. God would do what I would do if I were God. That is, if I were smarter, more powerful, and better, a better man than I am. That apparent projection is why I continue to class it under Nobodaddy. Indeed, Blake seems to have had this Nobodaddy more in mind when he mentions the silence of Nobodaddy amidst the suffering of his supposed children. Still, one would have to be exceedingly morally obtuse to chalk this argument up to ignorance or to deny the rationality of it. Dear God, hope you got the letter, and I pray you can make it better down here. I don't mean a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet because they don't get enough to eat from God. I can't believe in you. Contemporary atheism, driven by the problem of evil, is driven by a real appreciation, and often, but not always, a real horror of the reality of evil. And it would do no good for Christians to deny that reality in order to save God. I say not always, because in academic contexts within which I live, the problem of evil is often put forward by atheists who themselves aren't doing much about the suffering they know about and have the power to alleviate. It's as if they expect God to do what they themselves could, but don't do. It seems that they just don't want to believe in God, and the suffering of others is merely the occasion for justifying their unbelief. Still, there are many atheists genuinely horrified by suffering who cannot believe in a God who allows it, and we should accept not just the rationality of their atheism, but also its sincerity. As you may know, there is a philosophical response to the problem of evil from within the classical Christian tradition called the free will defense. That defense consists in suggesting that it isn't obvious that a good being must act to eliminate evil when he knows about it and can so act, since that might eliminate free will. The idea is that perhaps the reason why God allows for and tolerates evil is because of the great good of human freedom in the world. While this is part of the Christian tradition, I cannot help but find it unsatisfying. First, because the two figures of the Christian tradition I study the most, St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, while mentioning it, don't really put much weight on it. Second, I worry that other Christians who offer it go beyond speculating that free will may be the reason that God allows evil and suffering into suggesting that it is the reason why God allows it, as if we knew the mind of God. I will not deny the rationality of the atheist who does not think that his free will should be bought at the cost of the Holocaust or the death of a man sleeping alone on the streets in midwinter. The problem for Christians in offering the free will defense is the book of Job. Job asks God why all this crap is happening to him. God does not offer the free will defense in his own defense. God doesn't defend himself at all. What he does is put Job in his place. Who do you think you are? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who set its measurements, since you know. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. If this were the response of one man, however omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent, to another man, we would say the first man just told the second man to go to hell, or worse. Christians believe Job is a warning to those who believe in God, to those who believe in God, against trying to understand the reasons of God, as if he were just another Superman. And yet we Christians are tempted to put all our chips behind the free will defense. However, Christians also believe the response of God to evil is not just what God says to Job. Christians believe the ultimate and final response of God to evil and suffering is the birth of mercy from the womb of Mary. Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae. God does not tell us his reasons for allowing evil. If he did, would we understand? Wisdom begins, as Socrates said, in recognizing what we do not know. What God does tell us is how he responds to evil. Anybody who watches American football on TV knows. John 3:16. I once looked it up, because I didn't know. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him might not perish but might have eternal life. Thomas Aquinas teaches us that mercy of any sort springs from friendship. There is no genuine mercy from a distance in the absence of genuine friendship. And he goes on to teach us that God's mercy is the expression of divine friendship even in our creation and certainly in our redemption. I don't want to be so bold as to claim to know the reason why God allows evil. I fear that if I do, God will tell me to go to hell, or worse. But I do know what God's response to evil is. Merciful friendship for all human beings that begins by suffering with those who suffer evil, and then acts to alleviate it. I think the problem with the free will defense, besides the moral obtuseness with which it is often put forward by righteous Christians, is that it causes us to forget what we know about God's response to evil. It causes us to forget the face of mercy born of Mary looking at them from within her lap. Those without faith will say that they do not understand this. But again, we cannot accuse them of irrationality for failing to understand it, unless we are willing to accuse ourselves of irrationality for not understanding it either. There are truths that everyone knows that they may not understand. How can light be both a particle and a wave? We know that mercy is a person and died for all of us, even if we do not understand it. We call God our Father, but we are not praying to everybody's daddy. Nor when we believe what John 3:16 says, are we affirming our belief in Nobo Daddy. But this brings me to the third, possibly most important explanation of the rationality of atheism. And it has nothing to do with Nobo Daddy. It is what I like to call the problem of Christians. Those of us who are Christians know that we are made to the image and likeness of God. And we know what this means. We are called to a life of friendship with God and with one another in God, a communion of beatitude with all those whom God loves. What does this mean in our world? Well, again, we have a teacher. Christ taught us that to be made to his image and likeness is to be merciful. As his face is the face of mercy incarnate, we are to look like him. What does that look like? Well, we know. It looks like friendship that out of love approaches those who suffer and suffers with them, then acts to alleviate that suffering to the extent possible. When contemporary atheists look at contemporary Christians, is this what they see? Perhaps. But perhaps what they see is Christians living lives little different from them and all the rest, worshiping the gods of the city, even as they claim to worship the god who banished the gods of the cities of Athens and Rome. Who or what are the gods of Notre Dame? Who or what are the gods of Manhattan? Perhaps they also see us not truly befriending those who suffer, even if we do good works for them. Yes, they can see our hospitals and schools doing good works. But do they see something genuinely different in those hospitals and schools? Is Notre Dame just another NYU staffed mostly by Christians? Or is it something different, as a community of friends loving God and loving their neighbors in God? You tell me, and tell me who is my neighbor. It is well documented that Christianity spread in ancient Rome because the Christians did not leave Rome like everyone else in the hot summer months when deadly diseases spread. They remained with the pagan, poor and sick, befriended them, cared for them, and sometimes died with them. Good works are not the opera misericordiae without friendship, and there is no mercy from a distance. If atheists do not see something different in the lives of Christians living amongst them, except perhaps what they do in relative private on Sunday mornings and before they go to bed, or those good works without friendship that everyone else does, why would it be irrational for them to think there is no truly significant difference between being a Christian and being an atheist? Is this what atheists see when they look at us? The face of mercy springing from friendship? Perhaps from some of us, but all of us? Is this what they see when they look at me? I am called to be a friend of all whom I meet. One way to achieve that call is to not go out my front door, or the front door of the church, since I just won't meet anyone, and will thus not fail to be a friend to all those I meet. I can send a check, or even get better, go up, now that I'm, when I was younger it was send a check, now it's go online with my debit card. But I will never meet the man fallen upon the road. But you cannot accuse me of not befriending him, for I will never have met him within the church doors, unless I'm exceedingly lucky. I will also never meet an atheist within the church doors, unless I am even more exceedingly lucky. But this is not the way of mercy. It is not Christ's way to whose image I am made, since mercy cannot be lived from a distance. I am not called to be a doctor or a nurse or work in a soup kitchen. Although I can certainly visit the sick in friendship, even those friends I do not yet know, and eat in friendship with those in a soup kitchen, even those hungry friends I do not yet know. However, specifically, I am called to be a friend in educating others. Do I educate as a friend or as an employee? When I encounter an atheist along the road, does he see a friend or an enemy? Does he see a friend who is not scared by his atheism, but is rather pained by his lack of understanding? A friend who acts to help him understand. That's what I, a philosophy professor from the University of Notre Dame, need to ask myself. And if he does not see the face of mercy in me, I must grant that his atheism is pretty much perfectly rational. He is not Nobo Daddy. His is not Nobo Daddy atheism. It is Christian atheism. There are lots of reasons why people are atheists in our contemporary world, but perhaps it is the failure of Christians themselves to live to the image of mercy that is the phenomenon that best explains that, the rationality of contemporary atheism. It is at least the reason that I can do something about. If you want an atheist to have a chance of knowing and loving God, be merciful to him. If anyone says, "I love God but hates his brother," he is a liar. For whoever does not love a brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Thank you. Happy to field questions for as long as anybody wants to ask, but maybe Father White doesn't want that. I don't know. Yes, sir.
In my experience in New York, I encountered maybe many more times agnostics than atheists. And I wondered if you would comment on that. And the other implication I think I have correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're working on the premise that we have faith. And if we don't have faith, we go on pure reason, then it's more difficult, I assume, for us to defend our Catholicism.
Well, see, so two things there. Premise of faith, okay. The first, agnosticism, I've never been a... So if I have a problem being merciful to atheists, it's even more pronounced with agnosticism. Because I just want to say, look, get in the game, you know. I've read my Dante, and I know where the angels are who didn't choose. The really sad thing is, I mean, it's sad that they're out of heaven, but it's almost even sadder that even hell won't take them, right? It's like, who the hell wants them, right? You know, I'm sorry if there are any agnostics in the room, but there's agnosticism that's a kind of questioning agnosticism, that's a kind of inquiring agnosticism. And then there's a kind of, in the classical sense, slothful agnosticism, and that's the I don't care agnosticism. And that's the thing I have a hard time understanding. It just strikes me as lazy, and that's where I do think there's, for me, I've often thought that there's more hope in an atheist than there is in an agnostic, because the atheist has a passion for the truth. The atheist says the truth matters. And it seems to me that quite often, if it's not a questing, inquiring agnostic, if it's a genuine agnostic, there's no passion there, it seems to me. And there's a kind of sloth, there's a kind of unwillingness to pursue the good that one apprehends might be there, and so on. So, agnosticism is a different phenomenon, and it may well be the case. And perhaps we should worry more about agnosticism than atheism, right? Because it is a quite different thing. It's the angels in between heaven and hell. As far as the question of natural reason, so I was trying to, in a way, be mildly humorous about taking Thomas Aquinas seriously in starting the Summa Theologiae with that point. Another thing Thomas says, and this is not, when I told a friend of mine back at Notre Dame, in fact, a former teacher of mine when I was a graduate student there who's recently retired, we had lunch, and I told him what I was going to say. He said, "Don't become an anti-intellectual, John." And I said, "Why would this be anti-intellectual?" Right? He said, "Well, because, you know, reason, you know, we have to rely on reason." And I said, "I am relying on reason. I rely upon reason when I talk to my father, whom my mother told me about." So faith doesn't exclude reason, but there is such a thing as the exercise of reason without relying upon what's revealed. But I do think we have to be careful there, and for a reason that Thomas Aquinas himself gives, and that is, those who are going to do that have to be very careful that the arguments they have are in fact very good. Because as he says, bad arguments for the sake of the faith bring discredit upon the faith. Right? So there are plenty of people, and I know some of them, and some of them are my friends, but I won't give any names, who give arguments that I think to myself, look, that person will admit when the room is closed and we're drinking a beer that it's not a particularly good argument, but he'll say, but it works. It works with the audience. Well, that's about rhetoric, right? That's about sophistry. And he says, but it works and it helps the faith. And then I quote Thomas Aquinas to him. It brings discredit upon the faith. Because we should have the passion for truth. And wanting to have good arguments exhibits that passion for the truth. Wanting to have arguments that work whether they're true or not does not show that passion. So I'm not against apologetics, but I was saying beforehand, I wasn't named for John the Apologist. Right? There's a place for apologetics, I was at Notre Dame when they had the God debate, the first God debate. It was Christopher Hitchens and Dinesh D'Souza, and somebody said, "Are you going to go?" And I said, "Are you kidding? I mean, it's just going to be a shooting fish in a barrel, right? I mean, Christopher Hitchens, who's extraordinarily sophisticated rhetorically, and Dinesh D'Souza, who, God bless him, isn't. And doesn't actually know the good arguments, but knows the arguments that are typically given, which are not that good, or at least some of them are. And of course, afterwards, I said to somebody who went, and they said, well, yeah, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. And I said, and they took a poll afterwards. We have to have a poll. They took a poll of the students afterwards. Who won the God debate? Overwhelmingly, who do you think won the God debate? Christopher Hitchens. And that was because of bad apologetics. So I think there's a place for it, but it sure as heck better be very, very good. Otherwise, we don't do any good.
Thank you.
Here and then here.
Just two quick questions. One is, do you see people from sort of a scientific atheism camp and sort of a Christian philosophical camp using the word understanding in different ways or having different notions on what it means to understand? And then my second question is, when dealing with maybe people that are scientifically atheistic, you know, the scientists of the lack of a better word, do you notice a difference in your studies or research, like people that are from maybe a biological science and a problem versus people maybe with a cosmological sort of astronomical science base?
Well, the first, those are both in some ways sociological questions, but actually I think they're important because I do think you have to sort of, just like this, right? I was told broadly educated, well-educated audience, not everybody a philosopher, not everybody a theologian, but some philosophers and some theologians. Now talk. Right. Well, any speaker to be a good speaker, and I don't know if I'm a good speaker, but any speaker to be a good, I know what you have to do to be a good speaker, and that is you have to consider the audience. Well, consider that audience. What's going through the minds of all of you from very different backgrounds quite often, but you know, you're all living in Manhattan, you're all somehow or another associated with the Catholic center here, you know of these men in robes and the good they do, though they don't understand it. What do you mean by understanding? What does he mean by understanding? What does she mean by understanding? There's no question, and this is a serious question in philosophy, right? More recently, and I don't want to appeal to postmodernism because I don't think it's just postmodern, but for a long time here in the West, and we are in the West, and there's a lot of influence of that, the thought was there's just one mode of understanding. Okay? And it's a kind of deductive model. And then the deductive model is, the hypothetical deductive model is applied to science. And you deduce conclusions from your principles of the science. The conclusions from the principles of the science are possible observations. You test for the observations and so on. And that was the model of science until that broke down. That was the model of science through about the 19th century. It gets more complicated, partially because of quantum mechanics, but also partially because of some brilliant scientists saying, that's not actually just what we do. That's a very small part of what we do. The fact that you get a negative result in a observation is no reason to reject the theory. Though that's what I learned when I was in grade school. Right? You get a negative result, you reject the theory. No, you don't. You fix the theory. Until fixing the theory gets too complicated, and then you say maybe we should junk the theory and so on. We should go for a simpler theory. And so the notion of understanding, even within science. Even within science, it's much more complicated. But then you ask yourselves, well, what does it mean to understand? This goes all the way back to Augustine. What does it mean to understand who my father is? I understand who my father is. When I bring this up in my classes, I have students who say, well, you can test the DNA. And this is where it's really useful to have a scientific background. Because I can point out to them that in Los Angeles in 92 or 93, given the DNA test on the bloody glove, at least 20 people in Los Angeles would have met the DNA test, not just O.J. Simpson. Now make that the United States. Well, there's other reasons you would bring in as to why you would think it was O.J. Simpson or not. The science isn't going to determine it for you. What if your mother has an identical twin, or your father has an identical twin? What if your mother has an identical twin? As I like to say, it's only in a philosophy class that within about 10 minutes, with the door closed, of course, I can get everybody in the class, in intro, to deny that they know who their father is. And that's because they have a model of understanding that is extraordinarily narrow. What is it to know and understand a person? That's not science, but does that mean it's not knowledge and understanding? We need to think more about that, and that is a philosophical issue, but it's not particularly new. It's more like an issue that has been revived against the background of about 400 years of a particular model, right? I mean, I teach at the University of Notre Dame, and the University of Notre Dame says in its mission statement that it is a university where faith and reason can coexist. And we love that. We love it. But what does it tell you about the way we think about faith and reason? Reason's one thing. Faith is something else. Wait a minute, something other than reason. So it's non-reason. It's not knowledge, it's what? Well, you can substitute your favorite alternative to knowledge. Well, tell that to your mother. You know who your father is. Is that knowledge or not? Now think about that. That's more, it's a richer notion of knowledge that I don't think we quite understand. But it also takes place in science. I was a physics major. What did I have to do the first day I went into class? Prove to me that you should teach me physics. How would he do that? I don't know any physics. I wouldn't know if he was proving to me that he should teach me physics. What do I have to do? I have to look into him and say, well, for various different reasons, this is the person who will teach me physics. And maybe I will come to understand. But initially, it's like most of us knew 2 plus 2 equals 4. How many of us know that 2 plus 2 equals 4? How many of you have proven it? Mathematically, through deduction, as Descartes insists you must. Because if you don't do that, you don't know it. You've been socialized to that. First grade, teacher gave you a gold star. That's what your knowledge consists in. Or does it? So that is an extremely important question in this context. Right? What model of understanding are we using, and why should there be simply the one? Pascal was marvelous. Descartes was an algebraic geometrist, and deduction was the thing. Pascal went to Monte Carlo. So Descartes invents algebraic geometry. Descartes invents analytic geometry, sorry. Pascal invents probability mathematics. Both the inventors of a science. Two different models of what it is to reason, even in mathematics. So, very important question. Now, I've talked so much without saying much that the second one was about...
just like, you have a scientist that might have a biological...
Oh, yeah.
Versus like something cosmic, like a different reason.
Just, I think it depends upon the personal history of the particular science. In history, it's important that Aristotle was a biologist and invented biology. Plato was a mathematician, and if you look at their philosophical approaches, you see the obsession with math versus the obsession with life. Aristotle was fascinated by the fact, the difference between natural movement and unnatural movement, whatever you might make of that, there are things in this world that come at you, and nothing's making them come at you. Something within them is driving them at you, and that's living things. Plato has no interest in that. So that would be an example where the difference matters. In contemporary things, really depends. The inventor, or not the inventor, I keep saying inventor of a science, but one of the developers of Big Bang cosmology was an Augustinian priest, Father Joseph Lemaître, Belgian. There's a bust of him in the Pontifical Academy where I go every year in Rome, thank God, get to spend a few days there. Have to listen to a bunch of philosophy, but there's the restaurants. And every time I pass the bust of Father Lemaitre, I rub the nose. It's like Newt Rockne, the bust of Newt Rockne at Notre Dame. So it just depends on the individual. Yes?
Could you, in your experience with like playing
I don't know that there's no killer question, right? Again, you have to look at the person in front of you. And not just look at the person in front of you, you have to know them, which means you have to be friends with them. Then questions may come to you. Questions that, one of the things I have to deal with, given the fact that philosophy is required at Notre Dame, I can be pretty sure that my students have been taught a way of thinking about scientific understanding that if they're not atheists, they think that faith has no rationality to it because it's not scientific. I mean, we have Catholic biologists at Notre Dame, Catholic scientists at Notre Dame, who say science is about facts, faith is about emotions. And these are Catholics, practicing Catholics, right? And you're sort of, well, what am I going to say to them? Right. You have to know who it is and what it is that motivates and what in the background. You have to know the people you talk with, even though we've just met. So I don't think there is a kind of, you know, dumbfounding question that for everybody. In a certain way, with all due respect, I want to say, that wouldn't be the way I would think you go at it. I mean, that's looking for the dumbfounding question is, it seems to me, not presenting the face of mercy. I mean, and partially I think that because I work and teach in a philosophy department, and the vice of the of philosophical conversation, contemporary philosophy, is the gotcha question.
Sometimes, when you go with the free will,
well, so here would here. I mentioned the free will defense. I would be horrified if it turned out that I offered the free will defense to someone whose father had just died unexpectedly in the kitchen in front of him or her. And that's what's driving their atheism. They're saying, why did God allow this? If I don't know that person, right, I will have done extraordinary damage, I think, because you're not getting it if you think the free will defense is an adequate response. All the free will defense does is tell you it's logically possible for there to be an omniscient, omnibenevolent, omnipotent being and there be evil. That's all it tells you. It does not help the understanding of the person who is convinced by evil in a passionate way, a real way, to understand God's relationship to evil and God's response to it. There, I'm with the evangelicals. I was named for John, the apostle, who was the evangelist. You preach Christ crucified. I mean, Notre Dame has a crucifix in every classroom. And this happened to me. I was in class and I was teaching the problem of evil as a response, a particularly Thomistic expression written by a Dominican. And I'm looking at the students and I thought to myself, and fortunately the crucifix was up behind them, and I thought, my God, I'm just teaching them a bunch of bull. Because here I am, there's a crucifix on the wall, and I'm telling them that evil is acceptable because you have free will. That's not what God said. And so I just stopped teaching it. And then I start a conversation when people say, why don't you teach the free will defense? And then I can tell them that I know the defense and why I don't teach it. And that actually starts a conversation that goes on, rather than tomorrow we'll do another problem. So I don't know, that doesn't really help probably.
Yeah, thank you for speaking. You distinguish
But different kinds of Christians, and you talk of the Noble Daddy Christians and this more authentic.
It's not very charitable.
Christianity, and it occurs to me, I wonder, couldn't you say something similar about atheists? There's a different kind of atheism, not necessarily Gnosticism, but most of the atheists that I encounter at, say, my office would be atheists, but they import all these Christian values and sort of the care for the victim, and they sort of borrow all the terminology of Christianity, but deny the existence of God, and even Richard Dawkins strikes me as somebody who's kind of a main proponent of this kind of atheism.
Right.
I'm wondering what you would say about the rationality of that kind of atheism. Whereas the atheism you kind of pulled up in your talk, I don't encounter that kind of sober or serious atheism that much. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Well, I think that is one of the great ironies of, and this is, of course, the one place to start thinking about this is to read Nietzsche. I mean, there is this kind of, you know, inertia of Christian moral outlook amongst a world in which, as he says, it is God is dead, right? Even amongst, there are Christians for whom God is dead, right? And there are atheists for whom God is dead, and you can tell that the great thing about the Christians for whom God is dead and atheists for whom God is dead is they have the same morality, and it's Christian morality, right? You do not in this world, I think, in the contemporary world, I certainly have not, meet an atheist who doesn't think that we should have hospitals and hospitals should take care of people even if those people can't pay. The Romans didn't think that. Christians thought that. If you were born in most cities in the world, or in the country, in this country anyway, you were likely born, I mean, odds are, you were 50-50 at least, and perhaps better, that you would be born in a Christian hospital, or a hospital founded by Christians, either orders of nuns, or particularly evangelical Christians. South Bend has three hospitals, St. Joseph, St. Mary's that nobody goes to, and Memorial. Memorial was started by Methodists. And then there's the county hospital. Nobody goes to the county hospital because the county hospital was a mental institution. That's what county hospitals were. If you wanted care for ordinary illnesses or cancers and so on, you went to these hospitals. And everybody thinks that's a good thing, including atheists. And lots of atheists would say, in fact, they should be run by the government, but doing exactly what those hospitals do. The Romans didn't think that. So there's a kind of irony to that. One of the things I think one can point out about that irony is the fact that you're horrified by evil, I think, suggests that, Thomas even thinks this, right, that there is a tacit knowledge of the good. I mean, there is a tacit knowledge of God in those who desire the good, right? The genuine horror for evil, not the lazy horror, but the genuine horror of evil, it might well be that those people precisely do actually tacitly believe in God, because it's hard to understand without God what's evil about suffering. Right? I mean, why do we think suffering is something that we should help with and alleviate? I mean, where's that coming from? And not just where's it coming from, but the notion, right? I mean, as Nietzsche would put it, I love Nietzsche. He's my favorite atheist. He's like Thomas Aquinas inverted, right? Take everything Aquinas says inverted and you've got Nietzsche. Right? They would get along. There's good and bad. But you think it's evil. What does evil add to the notion of, well, that's just too bad? Right? There's a way in which the problem of evil is a problem for Christians precisely because they believe in God. The problem of evil isn't really a problem for people who don't believe in God unless they tacitly believe in God. Because you're like, well, what do you think? I want to say to Richard Dawkins, what's evil about that? For you, Richard, not me, for you. It horrifies me because I think we are all born to love God. And to love God, we have to work with one another and help one another because God loves each one of us. So I can kind of make sense of evil. But what do you make sense of evil? Well, as you point out, I think it's a kind of borrowing of the notion without understanding where it comes from. There's a one point, I see Father White is about to call the police. I'm working as Andrew. Yep. Yes, I got it, good. I'm terrible with names. As he mentioned, I'm working on mercy now, and I'm looking at the history of the development of the notion of compassion and mercy in the West. There's a very famous female philosopher who's extremely good, who's written a lot on this, I won't name names, who tells a story of mercy as going from Greek, the Greek word is aleos, from which we get kyrie eleison, the sort of feeling of pain when you observe somebody else's pain and you fear it's going to happen to you, so you help them. And it goes up through Aristotle, and then suddenly it reappears with Rousseau. And you look at that history, that tradition of mercy. The difference in Rousseau, though, is that it's universalized, where amongst the Greeks, the whole point in Aristotle and the Greeks was you felt this pain because the person was like you. And if they weren't like you, then you wouldn't feel pain when you see their suffering. And that's kind of the story of all the Greek tragedies. So it was particularized to those who are like you. And here the praise of Rousseau is, Rousseau takes that, after 1,600 years of its being, or even longer, almost 2,000 years of it being sort of forgotten, but he makes it universal. And I'm reading this and I thought to myself, anybody ever read about the Good Samaritan? Who is my neighbor? It's the person who suffers. And he's only called Anthropos in the story. He's a human being. Not like me, other than being a human being. So that's an instance in which here you get extraordinary scholarship that seems to be unaware of what's actually happening, driven by a kind of fear of admitting, I think, that the sources of this are not Greek or Roman. They're not pagan. They're who is my neighbor? The man of the law says, but who is my neighbor? So, I'm long-winded. Don't know if that helps. One more? People can obviously leave, but...
What do you say to people who, atheists who don't believe because of things that they, more specific things that they don't believe in, such as the church's stance on homosexuality or even, past atrocities that the church has committed?
Right. Well, again, I don't know what to say unless I know the person. I don't know, in terms of a teaching, right? The only thing I would say there is that's the fact that one does not understand or even agree with a particular teaching is no reason to be an atheist. Even for those who are, for those who are believers, I remember when a friend of mine was received as an adult into the Catholic Church, and I was his sponsor, and I was kind of shocked that all the priest did was ask him, do you accept as true, as everything the Catholic Church teaches as truly revealed by God? And I knew some of the things my friend believed. And I was like, wait a minute, let's get a book out here, right? I want him to have to go through page by page. And Father, I'll even point to the things that you should ask him about, right? But the fact is that there are lots of things I don't understand. There are lots of things that trouble me. There are lots of, I wouldn't say things that I deny, but there are certainly things that I have a difficulty with. But I've never thought that that was a reason to be an atheist. It might be a reason for me to have a very grave difficulty with the church, but it's not a reason for me to be an atheist, because I know Christians who are Christians, and they're not, they don't, how to put this, the theologians in the room would be better at this, but I know Catholics who are not atheists because of those teachings they disagree with. And they are Catholics, because what makes you a Catholic is baptism. It's not that, you should try to understand, you should try to learn, But that's what, it's not something you do, it's something that's done to you with your assent. And that's the start of something. I like to say it's like meeting someone that you come to love. You're not going to understand everything, and you might even have arguments, but you marry them because you come to understand, and then you come to have greater understanding. So that's one issue. The second part of it was, so what would I say to an atheist who says I'm an atheist because of the church's teaching on homosexuality? I'd say that's not a good reason to be an atheist. That's a good reason to be a Catholic troubled with the church and the church's teaching, but it's not a good reason to be an atheist. There are better reasons to be atheists than that. What was the second part?
Well, then there's kind of looking at the history of the church, sort of throughout the Middle Ages.
Yeah, there, actually I do have kind of a pat and probably too banal, too quick, too easy answer. I say, look at St. Peter. Jesus Christ knew that St. Peter would deny him three times. Right? Even after Peter said, "You are the Son of God," as the, "You are the Messiah," as the Gospel said the other day, Jesus Christ knew that. He knew that Peter would sin, and he chose Peter to be the rock. The fact that there's only one apostle who went to the cross with Christ. 11 of the 12 bailed. Human fault was not eliminated. God died for us, but he did not cause us to cease to sin, to fail. The fact that all sorts of things that have gone on in the church are the failings of human beings. There's no question about that. It was never a church of the saved on this earth. We're not a club. Walker Percy, a wonderful author, once who converted to Catholicism, was asked, "Why did you become a Catholic?" by his sort of Southern Presbyterian relatives, none of whom practiced, but they went to services, but all of them were atheists, he would say, but of course they went to Presbyterian services in the South. They were Stoics, he would say. They all said, "How can you become a Catholic? How can you become a Catholic? I mean, God, look at the sin, the drinking," right? And all of his, as he would say, all of his relatives drank. But they drink and they get drunk and then they go to confession the next day and then they go to Mass. They're hypocrites and they're low-down people and they're awful people and they're sinners. That church is so full of sinners. And Percy just said, the Roman Catholic Church is a very good place for sinners to be. And that's why there are so many in it. We should expect failure. Peter denied Christ three times. What could be worse? Well, maybe the Crusades. But denying Christ when he's your best friend? I don't know. And yet Christ said, I think he probably did it because of that. Peter was the stupid one. I'm going to build the church on the stupid one. He didn't build the church on John, the one who wrote in Greek, "In the beginning was the Logos." So it's not an apology for the Crusades, but I don't think. I mean, the reason the church is here is to help us with our failure. Even those who in the church fail and help us. Sorry, I don't know. That's my pat answer to that. I just don't. That one's not for me. Never been an issue. I just like.
Good answer.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please help me in thanking Dr. Bauman.